So I'm going to go through a little bit. I want to amplify a couple of things that Abby said, and really kind of talk to you about what this partnership is trying to do and why it's so important to public health, and what are some takeaway messages on that. So disclaimer, I don't know, it's supposed to be on the second slide. There, it's on the second slide. So what is a sustainable community? Blah, 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 wonk, 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 wonk. A sustainable community is a community that actually works with you. It allows you to get to the places where you need to get to in a way that you like to get to, that doesn't cost a lot of money, and that increases how you like to live, increases your quality of life, your joy in getting from point A to point B. So we put this up there, and you can read about it, and we're all big policy wonks, but essentially, you know, the fundamental piece is a sustainable community works for you. And I think that often gets lost in the whole mix. So what's not sustainable? I love this set of slides. I got them about a year ago when I was working in Ohio. This is Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, which is essentially Cleveland. Red represents how much was developed, and the population is about 1.4 million post-World War II. Post-World War II. And then in 2002, not surprisingly, the entire county has been built out. But did you notice that, I haven't gotten the population. The population really hasn't changed. So looking at this, the population has more or less stayed the same, but the entire county has been built out. Now look at it from another perspective, not about a sprawl perspective. Think about the amount of money the taxpayers have paid to build water infrastructure, to build the transportation infrastructure, to build the public infrastructure necessary to support that type of expansion. And here's the killer of it, it's supported by the same number of ratepayers. When I met with the governor's office in Ohio, they called this economic suicide. And this is occurring in communities across the United States. This is what we would call not sustainable. And what happens is when everything is kind of spread out, we're driving a lot. I don't need to tell you all that. Here's a nice wonky slide about it. But when we drive a lot, we don't walk. And when we don't walk, we get fat. All right, this is a public health conference. I don't need to talk to you about the rising obesity epidemic in the United States. And the sidewalk, of course, is one of the reasons, as I'll get further into the talk, about why we're not walking as much. And not only when we spread out like that, there are tremendous environmental impacts to that type of development. Our water quality gets worse, our air quality gets worse, we have a loss of habitat, we're moving out of the central cities, we're essentially abandoning downtowns. The GAO, the Government Accounting Office, estimates that there are about 4 million brownfield sites in the United States. So I just want to narrow down just one, you know, this is a very, again, wonky slide about data and environmental. So let's just focus in on water. So when we convert our forests and meadows to impervious cover, right, parking lots for schools and roads and whatnot, we generate runoff. And if we generate too much of it, it goes rushing into our streams for degradation, and it can lead to floods, and it can create public health hazards. I mean, this goes directly back to what you all are talking about here. So not only did we talk about the kind of environmental impacts on public health, community design and health are actually really linked. You know, we talked about the related to land use, the rising obesity epidemic, the water quality, but there's also a number of health impacts related to our auto dependency around the rising asthma rates, the air pollution, the car crashes. I mean, that's actually a really big issue. We've been working with the Emergency Responders Association, so the fire chiefs and the police chiefs, about why we need to have greater connectivity, right? Simply because it reduces the number of car accidents, and it slows people down. It reduces the number of, it increases public safety. I can get much more into that. And then social processes. What we're finding as the baby boomers age, that people are increasingly feeling separated from their community because we live in these pods. So when we think about the aging population, if we're designing our communities for the way we are, how are our aging population folks going to live? That doesn't, if I was getting a little bit older and a little bit slower, I am getting older and a little bit slower, but even older and slower still, these streets would be kind of hard to cross. And of course, many aging Americans are having trouble driving. But more broadly than that, I go into my son's class. He's now in second grade. I did this in kindergarten and first grade. And the very first question that I ask the classes, and I do this on Earth Day, is, how many of you drive? And again, these are a bunch of first graders, and none of them raise their hands. And I say, do you know that 4 out of 10 Americans don't drive? It's true. When you take the kind of the kids and the older folks, right, that's almost half of Americans don't drive, yet we're designing our communities where the only way you can access goods and services and your life is through an automobile, and that's really not sustainable. And so let's say, for example, that you do, you're one of those folks that decide to go out and try to walk. If you're in a wheelchair, if you're pushing a stroller, this all of a sudden becomes really difficult sidewalk to navigate. And this issue of connectivity. So you put in a sidewalk, but you're not really thinking about where you're putting the sidewalk, and it doesn't really quite work. As I said, you know, my son's now 8. I'm always looking at community design through the perspective of a mother, of course, because I am one. And the whole idea of stroller pushing, right? I hate pushing grocery carts, and I hated pushing a stroller. But I began to think about how the community operated so much differently when I was pushing my 6-month-old down. And this would have driven me crazy. And I'm not even in a wheelchair. I'm not using a cane. I don't have a walker. I don't have a cast on my foot because, you know, from a skiing accident. These are things that happen all the time. And again, we're designing our communities for the car, right? So what does a sustainable community look like? This is one of my favorite examples, and it's probably one of the best examples of transit-oriented development in the United States. And this really kind of gets at the core of what the partnership's trying to do. Can everyone hear me? So the federal government in the 1970s invested a huge amount of money into, this is Arlington, Virginia, into the metro system outside of Washington, D.C. So the county was able to leverage federal investments, and instead of tracking the metro through Route 66, which follows along here, which is a highway, they said, nope, let's leverage this federal investment and instead put the metro underground and move it through the center of Arlington County. It was brand new thinking. It took a lot of political will because these neighborhoods were kind of dying and decaying. This is 1970s. There wasn't a lot going on here. But what they were able to do is leverage this public investment for high intensity of uses, which then tapers down into townhomes, which tapers down into single-family detached homes. Again, wonk, 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 wonk. What does this mean for you? You're out of college, you're moving to D.C. because you got an internship on the Hill, and you're moving into an apartment with a bunch of your friends right on top of Boston Metro, and that works great for you. And you meet someone, you think they're kind of nifty, you get married, but you don't have a lot of money, and you buy a townhouse right here. You have a couple of kids, right? You need a little bit more space. You buy a single-family detached home. They go off to college. You're tired of mowing your lawn, and you move back into your condo. Well, so what does that mean? That means you have aged in place. You have visited the same dry cleaner, the same grocery store, the same center market. You have aged in place. You know the community. This is a community that is built for the people. It is built for your changing needs. Now, not everybody is going to stay in place, and not everyone's going to follow that trajectory. But the point is that you have that option too. You have the option of staying in your community as your needs change. Where am I? And these types of communities, I can go on forever and ever about the environmental and the community benefits. But since this is a public health community, public health conference, I really want to focus on the health benefits. When you build more compact and walkable communities, you walk. When you build with the pedestrian in mind, when you build with the person in mind, you walk more. And when you walk more, you're a little bit healthier. There have been tons of studies, which I'm sure Kathy can tell you about. She wanted me to come and talk about the partnership, which I'll get to in a minute. But there have been tons of studies that if you're a middle-aged white man living in a suburb of Atlanta, you're going to weigh 10 pounds less if you're living in a community built around these kind of design principles than if you are living in a kind of more dispersed, large lot development. It's just, you know, good weight gain, just move into a more compact community. Good weight loss, sorry, opposite. And so when you're thinking about how are we designing our communities, why does design matters, we think about it in the 3Ds, distance, right? Like distance to destinations. A friend of mine, when I joined a mom's group, they moved just a mile away to be in a bigger house. And what she said to me at one point in time, she was like, there's no place to walk to, I never walk. She just moved a mile away, but there was no destinations. There were sidewalks. The design was right. It was still a compact community, and it was mixed use, but there was no destinations. And the distance between these destinations, right, was too great for her to walk. It was about a mile and a half. And whereas to get to any place interesting, whereas before it was about a half mile for, right? So, and this is a good example of the type of development that we have been, right? It's the same number of uses. We've accommodated the same amount of stuff on essentially the same type of land. But here we separated the mall from the houses from the school. And often what you'll find here from a public healthy or a public safety perspective is there'll be a fence around the school. So if you're living right here, the school's right here, because of the fence, you won't be able to actually walk there. How many people have a fence around their local school? Yeah, that's just, I've seen it, I see it all over the place, when particularly in these kind of, you know, dispersed neighborhoods, a fence around the school, so it's getting really hard to get the kids in. And you can understand why the school did it. They're trying to protect the kids. But by this kind of protection, they're not looking at this broader perspective of we're not getting out, we're not exercising, we're being divorced essentially from our natural environment. So to bring the point home, design matters. This is Anywhere USA, and I'm living in that star right here, and I need to get to some goods and services, and this is my street. But it's not really designed for people, so, right, it becomes really difficult to walk. There's a sidewalk on one side of the street, and this may sound like a very esoteric design wonky thing, but there's no buffer, there's no parked cars, there's no steep street trees. And the next time you're walking down a street, just think for a minute. Do I like walking down the street? Is this fun? Just think for a moment. And if you say yes, begin to think why. Is it because there's a row of parked cars right next to me so I feel a little bit safer? Are there interesting things to look at on my other side? Are there some trees where I feel shaded? And if you don't feel comfortable, is it because the cars are rushing by at 30, 40 miles an hour that there's nothing interesting to look at? All of these things play into our psyche of how much we walk and why walking and design matter so much. And then a lot of our retail is really oriented around the car, you know, drive-through. I don't need to beat that horse. And then here, if you were trying to take public transit someplace, and it's a hot day, or if it's a snowy day, you're completely exposed to the elements. And oftentimes, too, now we have next bus and new GPS tracking, but buses can be late, and so you're out there for a considerable period of time. I was recently in Portland, Oregon, when the president was there a couple of weeks ago, which meant that there was no hotels anywhere downtown. And so I was at a bed and breakfast about 3 miles outside of town, but I didn't worry about it too much. It was a block off the bus route. So I'll just take the bus in. And this is Portland, Oregon. How many people know Portland, Oregon is like the mecca for a sustainable community? And I was at a bus stop on the side of a busy road with cars rushing by just standing next to a pole. I took a cab. And I believe in this stuff. And I was like, oh, this is really not fun for me. This is Portland. And ADA, curb compliant. Again, you can use ADA as looking at it from a person with disabilities perspective, but also think of it from a person who might not be feeling so well, has a cast in their leg, is pushing a stroller. ADA is more than just for disabilities, it's about accommodating people through all stages of their life. That's the way I think about it. And then because the way that this community has been designed, paratransit is going to be needed for some of the aging population in this community or otherwise disabled, and that's going to ramp up the fiscal cost for the community. And then another example, this mixed-use senior center is nationally accredited. Senior center, nationally accredited. And let's go through that, because so the client base, right, is seniors. But there's a huge parking lot here. So you're assuming then that the seniors are all going to be driving here, all right? And also all of this parking in front is another barrier for walkers. The building's not right up to the street, not right up to the sidewalk. Right, but even then, all that parking isn't enough because on the lot right next door, you can't park there. So we're creating even more impervious surface. And then you got sore hips, you got a walker, you're on crutches. Those stairs are going to be pretty hard to navigate, right? So the message that this whole design is sending is pedestrians not wanted. Thank you very much, but go to the next one. And very simple, how do we change this very pedestrian inhospitable environment to something that's a little bit more hospitable? So look how wide those lanes are right up here. Right here and right here. Look at how wide those lanes are. This is key to, the rest of it is just frosting, but those lanes and that width, they just narrowed them. That's it. A fire truck can still get down, but by narrowing the lanes, you're driving a little bit slower, which is going to be safer for everybody involved. You're still accommodating the same amount of traffic flow, but you've moved in the streets a little bit more, so you don't spend as much time crossing the street. It becomes a little bit safer, becomes a little bit more friendly, and then you begin to add more of the design issues of putting the buildings right up to the sidewalk, putting in greenery. It's a more interesting pedestrian environment. Design matters just not for community health, but also for climate change. The same strategies that we would use to help rebuild our communities or to build communities that are going to be resistant to climate change, but also serve as a climate change mitigation strategy, are the exact same strategies that we would use now to build more healthier communities. So we design now for climate change impacts, 50, 100 years from now, but we get an immediate health dividend. All right, so I'm from the EPA. What am I doing talking about local land use? That is crazy talk. EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment, and where and how you build has dramatic implications for our air, water, and land resources. Furthermore, when we sat down with our partners at DOT and HUD, we all realized we can't do our core mission well without working with you. And if your core mission, let me point to a HUD person, if HUD's core mission is to provide affordable housing, well, they need to link with transportation. And if transportation's core mission is to provide safe and efficient and cost-effective transportation for their constituents, they can't do it unless you align the water infrastructure and the brownfield and the environmental management piece along with the housing piece, that we all need to work together comprehensively to leverage each other's programs in order to meet our core mission goals. So this is the exact same slide that Abby had, but I do want to amplify on a couple of points. This is nothing less than a game changer. The purpose of the partnership is to align federal investments, policy, administrative actions, and requirements to promote sustainable communities. And by sustainable communities, we mean the 6 livability principles. This is enormous. I mean, Abby mentioned very briefly about putting out the joint funding from HUD and DOT. Sorry, it's been a long week. But what we're trying to do is to say, listen, EPA spends $3.3 billion on water infrastructure, and what we're trying to do is to say, listen, we want communities to put your water infrastructure dollars where you're putting your transportation dollars, where you're putting your housing dollars, to really begin to align and leverage these investments. It's not going to work everywhere. Absolutely, there's going to be places where HUD needs to spend or a community needs to spend its affordable housing dollars to provide just that. But let's be clear, this is 2010, and the era of single objective spending is over. As a country, we can no longer afford just to put in water infrastructure pipes to out to a development 10 miles out of town because that's what we've all agreed to do. We can no longer afford to run highways to connect two communities. We need to be thoughtful and mindful about where we're placing these investments to leverage one another. It's hard, it's tricky. And we have a lot of support, but that's exactly what the partnership is trying to do. It's defined by the 6 livability principles. Clearly, we didn't coordinate our slides. Sorry about that. But let me talk a little bit about what we're trying to do. We're trying to reinvest in our existing neighborhoods. One of my biggest beefs is that schools, and this is even at my son's school. How many of you recycle cans? You know, you're 12. Probably everybody. Oh, John Hopkins. You don't recycle a can, really? I didn't mean to pull you out. That was rude. But cities have these huge programs about canned recycling. We wouldn't even think about throwing away a can. Yet communities often walk away from buildings downtown. Communities will walk away from their schools. Did you know that most states have a standard about school siting criteria that if rehabbing the school costs 50% more than building a new school, then just go ahead and build a new school? What? Really? We're throwing away buildings. And really, that's what this partnership is trying to do, is to bring bring attention back to the investments, the public investments that we have already made, and to support those public investments. I talk a lot about water quality, and again, this is public health, but what we're trying to do in aligning our federal policies, Abby mentioned really briefly HUD's huge win on the ability to redevelop a brownfield and put multifamily housing on it. Now, that may not be appropriate in all cases, but in some cases, you're going to have a lot of brownfield sites that are right next to public transit and other amenities, and so to be able to build higher density, to be able to put multifamily housing is huge. In the same way, EPA is looking very critically at its stormwater resources and its stormwater requirements. If you're, like we talked about impervious surface, if you have the same requirements for knocking down a forest and building a parking lot or directing that development to an already degraded area, from a water quality perspective, it's always going to be better to direct development to places that's already graded. You get a win-win. You get the benefits associated with development, and you have no net degradation whatsoever on water quality. So we're looking at our stormwater regulations to really begin to incentivize or to recognize that type of environmental protection. Abby talked a lot about the different grants that are available, but let's be clear, we talk so much about community design. And so if I were you and sitting there, I'd start be asking, well, that's great, this community design is so important, how am I going to do it? The 45 grants that went out to regional planning under the HUD's regional planning grants is essentially, you know, $100 million to help 45 regions to begin to do just that, to think comprehensively, how can we change where and how we're growing as a region? How can we begin to leverage our own community resources for better outcomes? The challenge grants were $40 million, and the Tiger planning grants were about $32 million, 30. So about $70 million went to how many, 67 communities? And that's to bring it down even further. These applications were a joy to read and what they were trying to do. And so many of them had an aging component. So many of them had a, how can we design our community to age in place? They were doing other aspects of it as well, but you should know that these funds that are now available are geared directly to help make possible a lot of the things that I talked about today. There's a document that we came out with called Leveraging the Partnership, DOT, HUD, and EPA Programs, and it's available on the web below. But that's the other piece that we're doing. If our outcome is to create more sustainable communities, if our outcome is to really begin to leverage resources and to get to better community design, how can we modify all of our programs? So the partnership not only works across agencies, but we also very much work within our own agencies to begin to align our own policies and programs. And these are just some examples, like Safe Routes to School, for example, HUD DOT, the HOPE 6. We have a lot of Stormwater Revolving Fund. I'm not going to read these slides. They're all available, but I do encourage you, if you're looking for resources and information, to go there. A couple of last points that I wanted to make. I get asked all the time, well, this is great. How come CDC is not part of the partnership? How come the Economic Development Agency is not part of the partnership? And where's FEMA? And what about USDA? Yes, you're all right. They all should be part of the partnership. But how many of you ever in your professional lives or in graduate school or in high school ever had to work on a team? The more people you add, the slower you go and the harder it is. So at this very initial point, we're about a year and a half old, we're keeping it really small. That is not to say that we're not working with CDC very closely on how we can leverage our work and the work that CDC is doing for better public health outcomes. As a for example of that, we're working with the CDC now to incorporate Walk Score. Does everyone here know what Walk Score is? Oh, well, Walk Score was developed by a nonprofit, which essentially says you type in your, and it's walkscore.org. Everyone should do it for fun. You type in your address and it pops up what your walk score is. It's essentially a barometer of how sustainable your community is. And clearly, those addresses that are kind of more out in the edge, your single family detached homes, are going to have lower walk scores. And those that are closer in, that have access to libraries, restaurants, stores, public parks, schools, all of these things are incorporated. So what we're doing with the CDC is to incorporate Walk Score as part of the multiple listing service. So you're buying a home, and you can see then what your Walk Score is. Now, it's not going to be important to everybody, but it will be important to some people. There have been a number of market surveys done over the last last 10, 15 years about who wants to live in these kind of new urban communities, right? The federal government is mandating that everybody lives in a condo market, in a condo above a metro, and that's not it at all. These market surveys that are done by the National Association of Realtors, the Home Builders Association, Heritage Foundation, Smart Growth America, pretty much, so both sides of the aisle, pretty much show across the board that anywhere between 30 and 50% of the American population want to live in these type of communities. But that also means that about 50% of the population wants to live in a single-family detached home, and that's okay. What we're trying to do in the partnership is really focus on the 30 to 50% that want to live in these types of communities, mostly because we believe, and the research demonstrates, it has better health outcomes, better fiscal outcomes, better environmental outcomes, better economic outcomes, and better community of life outcomes. And so if you then ask, well, Lynn, how much is the market responding to building these places? It's less than 1%. So if the market demand is somewhere between 30 and 50% and we're, as a market, we're responding to less than 1%, there's our window of opportunity. And from the federal government, let me also say that absolutely local land use can and should be and always will be a state and local issue. We are not getting involved in that at all. But by the same token, we are stewards to your money. I'm assuming everyone here pays taxes. Right? And so the idea is that a community can grow any way that they so choose, and that is entirely okay. Do what you will. But what we're saying is, from a federal perspective, we're going to invest our federal resources into places that have better economic outcomes. Kathy also wanted me to give a little prop to Growing Smarter, Living Healthier, which is essentially an advocacy, or not advocacy because EPA put it out, but educational information about, if you are a senior, what are some tools and strategies and steps that you can take to get more involved in your community. So I know I covered a lot, but if there's any, as Kathy say, any burning questions, I'm more than happy to answer them now. Yes, ma'am. I'm so sorry that I pulled you out. I'm being really...
I've been really frustrated, especially with the Tiger, too. Abby actually grew up in the community. It's a rural community in northern Michigan. And there's sprawl everywhere. And there are no sidewalks, very few sidewalks, disconnected. We have a bus service. We're trying to reestablish the downtown community, revitalize it. There's no money available. We have buildings that have been empty for years because it's cheaper to build a new one.
Yeah.
How do you get that message to rural planners? I mean, I stood in front of the city council for an hour and a half, and they lambasted me as I'm trying to explain to them federal regulations and why I'm writing this Tiger grant, why I have to put this in, and why we have to collaborate here. You know, the one comment was, why do we have to partner with these foreigners in Australia? I mean, why do we have to partner with the Dallas State?
Oh, it's not my community.
I mean, how do you get, this is absolutely wonderful information. How do I get them to buy into this process?
You know, you should have heard my talk yesterday, which was, because we're doing a Governor's Institute on Community Design for rural communities, and it's in Golden, and I'm going to leave here to go there. And yesterday I talked all about this vis-a-vis of rural lens. And the whole conversation, you have state directors from a number of different state agencies, as well as local folks from the states of the Region 8, so North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado, all talking about what do we need to do to really begin to infuse this in rural communities. And so if this was my computer, I'd pop up the one slide where I listed all the partnership activities around just that one issue. But very briefly, one of the priorities for the partnership this year is on rural communities. So while in the $100 million planning grants, $25 million of it was set aside for small communities, the other, so we'll think of it in two groups, big and small. So for the big pot of money, that was oversubscribed. I think there was over $600 million dollars worth of applications for essentially a $75 million grant. But for the smaller communities, that $25 million, there was only $29 million submitted. So one of the priorities of the partnership this year is to develop programs, tools, implementation assistance, and capacity building specifically for rural planning organizations. And what came out yesterday is the real need to develop marketing materials, for lack of a better word,
for rural communities. This is considered, and by rural, I'm including tribes in there as well, because I'm in region. So sorry about that first misstep. But that's what's being identified as a real need, because so many folks are sitting exactly where you're sitting, and it's falling on deaf ears. Sir, in the back, it's another burning question.
In my private life, I'm the chair of the Planning Commission in Golden, Colorado. And it's all about getting things like healthy and sustainable communities, age-friendly communities, all these words we use. It's all about relationships. Yeah. And it's all about community becoming active. Yet it takes years. So don't be frustrated. You know, I've been in Golden for 11 years, and now I'm chair of the Planning Commission. So you take years and years to get the community involved with many meetings to make these changes. But the citizens really will, with lots of meetings, ask for this and understand this.
It's multifaceted. He's absolutely right. It is about relationships building. It's also that there haven't been enough tools and assistance specifically directed to rural communities, and which is to our own detriment, because the research has shown that a strong urban core needs strong suburbs and needs strong rural communities. Everybody walks together. Kathy now is standing up.
So I'm going to take any other questions when we all come to the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you.